We are 1 year into this fun project of ours, and it has been a great thrill. I hope you guys have enjoyed a lot of the interviews with some of our favorite local, both Atlanta and Georgia stars of the past, both on the field, in the broadcast booth, and in some cases in my business. So we wanted to look back at some of the Hall of Famers that have graced us over the past year, give you a chance to hear from the Hall of Famer Chipper Jones, former Hawks great Dominique Wilkins, and the man with the biggest kick in Atlanta Falcon history, the Hall of Famer Morton Anderson. So let's start it now with the man named Larry Jones that they call Chipper.
Well, let's talk about that, because 94 ends with the strike and there's no World Series. And in some weird way, were you, and this is a weird question, were you kind of happy that there was, you didn't miss that in 94, that chance?
100% I was happy, because when the Atlanta Braves won the World Series, I wanted to be there the first time that it happened. And I wanted to have, you know, some sort of say-so. And it's not that I was pulling against Atlanta or rooting against the guys or what have you, but from a selfish standpoint, I wanted to be a part of the first championship, here in Atlanta. And so, man, when Sid slid, golly, I was so happy, various other things happened throughout the course of the early 90s, man, I was happy for the guys. But, when it didn't exactly go our way in the postseason, I was like, man, it's going to happen. You know, we're going to wait until I get there, and then we're going to get it done. And I'll be dang if it didn't happen exactly that way. It was pretty cool.
Well, 95, though, you had to wait because the thing drags on, and spring training started maybe 30, 40 days late. So how tough was that to wait on essentially getting back on the field for you?
Yeah, I was like a caged lion at that point. It was pretty tough to get through, knowing that here we go into basically went into April before we got the call that the strike was over. I think we might have had, 13, 15, 18 day spring training, really, really short spring training. In our first, first game of the season, I think didn't start until May, so it was kind of, all hands on deck and let's get ready as fast as we can and get this season started. And I'll never forget, to this day, I couldn't imagine a better way to start the season than we did that opening game. We were facing Terry Mulholland of the San Francisco Giants, and the first six hitters of the season got base hits and scored in the first inning. I mean, talk about sending a message and setting the tone, for the season. That's a pretty good way to do it. That, and in the top of the first inning, I ran over Greg Maddux on a pop-up. So, it's kind of my come to Jesus, welcome to the starting in the big leagues moment.
So as that year plays on and plays out, what is the biggest transition for you in the bigs, either at the plate or in the field or just everyday life? What's the biggest transition playing at that level?
Staying even keeled, knowing that there are going to be those roller coaster rides during the course of the summer. You're going to go through your 0 for 18s, your 0 for 20s. You're going to go, 10 for 15 with five homer stretches. These are the roller coasters that you have to stay even keeled as much as possible. And I can think of nobody, better to learn from than the guys in the Braves clubhouse, whether it's Tom Glavine and the poise he displays, whether it's, Doggy, sitting me down and assuring me, even though we got a one or two game lead in the division, in June, he's like, we're going to win this division by 15 games, and just that confidence and that calm to be able to know, hey, we're better than anybody else. It's just a matter of time before we start playing that way, and then we're going to run off with this thing. And it was just, that even-keeled attitude that really made us made us successful for a very, very long time.
So how hyped are you when you guys get to the postseason, specifically you, for the first time? It was a weird format back in the beginning of the wild card era when you guys had to play on the road at Colorado. How did you – could you keep yourself kind of low-key for that big of a moment?
It was difficult. I can remember the day, you know, that we were in Colorado. I was scared to death because, you know, the Blake Street Bombers were – just that. I mean, they had a bomb squad. They had, you know, four or five guys that had 30, 40 homers, you know, Bichette hitting 370, 380, leading the league. I mean, it was the scariest place to play because there were so many variables that were out of your control in Colorado. Obviously, with the elevation, you know, it's heaven on earth for a hitter. And if you walk guys and you make errors and you throw the ball in the middle of the plate out there, they're going to embarrass you. And we knew that. We knew we had to, you know, have our best game, you know, put our best foot forward whenever we went out there. And those first two games were the scariest. We were down in both games. And I still say this, I think my first playoff game may have been the best game that I ever played in my life. I think I hit a home run in the seventh to bring us to within a run. I made a diving backhanded play on Andres Galarraga down the line and ended up getting a force out, which prevented, you know, a multi-run inning in the bottom of the eighth. And then I came up in the ninth off Curtis Luskanic and broke a tie with a home run in the top of the ninth to propel us. I think the score was 5-4 in that game. And I think we came back and beat them like 4-3 in the second game. So to be coming back home against a very dangerous team, even though they did beat Smoltz in game three, we put it on Saberhagen pretty good in game four to kind of get them in our rearview mirror and kind of get us, you know, off to a good start and with a lot of momentum going into the Cincinnati series in the LCS.
Now, you guys rolled. I mean, they were close games, but you guys end up sweeping them in that 95 series. So let's look at the World Series for a second and compare that feeling of your first AB in Colorado and the first time in the field. How different or similar maybe was it on the World Series stage?
Yeah, scared to death again. You know, I know that the World Series is what the Division Series was on steroids, no pun intended. It was Cal Ripken throwing out the first pitch, who was my idol. You know, I mean, I grew up idolizing this guy. Talk about fangirling. You know, a dude, that's how I was with Cal Ripken. He gave me a baseball, and I'll never forget what he wrote on the baseball. He said, "Chip, you're off to a great start. Now the hard part starts, staying here." You know, and I have it on my mantle to this day. I'll never forget it. But those words rang true with me, you know, throughout my career. But also, you know, another guy that I idolized because I was such a big Dodger fan growing up was Oral Hershiser. I mean, guess who's starting game one of the World Series, you know, against us for the Cleveland Indians, none other but Oral Hershiser. So haven't seen this cat dominate World Series games before, haven't seen this guy, I think, throw 59-plus innings of and never not give up a run, you know, during one stretch. That is unreal. That'll never be done again, you know. So now here I am, little old Chipper Jones from Pearson, Florida, stepping in the box against the great Oral Hershiser. To say that it was a little intimidating was an understatement. But he still got to throw that ball over that 17-inch plate. And if he does, it's my job to whack it. And he did. And I hit a screaming bullet to Vizquel at shortstop, and I hit into a double play there in that first AB. But it calmed me down. It was like, you know what? He's not a god. He's still got to throw it over that plate. And if he does, you're gonna rake it.
So, Chip, you guys have that 3-2 lead in the series. Take me to that day, that from the morning until the time you guys play, because For those who don't remember the controversy, which to me was so blown out of proportion, with Justice saying he just wanted our fans to show up the way they did with the kind of impact in the early 90s. So from that moment to that night, like, is that 12 hours or that day? How long does it feel?
It wasn't as long for me as it was for Dave. I think we all picked up the paper that morning and go, oh, no, you know, this is not going to be received well. And true to form, it wasn't. You know, I don't know what was taken out of context or if anything, but the fact of the matter is, you know, he says some things I really think maybe he wishes, you know, he could take back or hadn't said. But the fact of the matter is I think David plays better when he's pushed to the limit. And I think that he kind of felt like he had backed himself into a corner and he was public enemy number one. And you know what? All these people who are booing me, they'll be cheering me by the end of the night. And, you know, I just remember Glav coming in the fifth or sixth inning, you know, of game six, and him saying, boys, all I need is one. And at that point, when your starting pitcher says, all I need is one, he is in full command. And I think it was, you know, I think David was leading off the sixth when he hit it. And, you know, that was the shot heard around the southeast, to be honest with you, because I can't think other than, you know, Hank's 714th or 15th, you know, David Justice has the biggest sports moment in Atlanta sports history as far as I'm concerned.
So then in the ninth inning, give Wohlers credit, man, it was no drama, although the ball by area hits was put a little pack into it. So as you see the ball land in Grissom's glove, could you prepare yourself for that feeling ever?
No, I couldn't. I would never let myself. You know, to be honest with you, as scary as that lineup is when you got Lofton leading off the night, I felt like if we got him out, like I really felt the game was over. You know, he could steal second, steal third, no problem, and, you know, a nothing ground ball or a fly ball to the outfield would have scored him to tie the game. So it was imperative that we keep him off base. We did that. It was an extra bonus to get the scale out. But I think, you know, Woe was just in one of those grooves where you can tell a closer, when he's running in, the game is over. And Woe was as dominant and as automatic as anybody that year. We played a ton of close games. We didn't score a lot of runs that year in 1995, but we won a lot of really close 2-1, 3-2, 3-1 games during the course of the season. So he was well-versed in those situations. And I think when the ball went up, I thought Gapper, you know. And then the next image that popped into my mind was, oh God, Albert Bell's coming up, you know. And true to form, we always shaded hitters the other way in the outfield, and Grip made it look pretty easy out there in left center. And at that point, you see it fall into his glove, and I turned around, and I didn't know what to do. I just started running in towards the mound, and I saw Javi and Woe embrace, and you can just see this bright-eyed kid kind of hugging both of them with his mouth wide open, and got a big old chaw of tobacco in my mouth, you know, that everybody can see. And at that point, everything went dark because we hit the ground and everybody, you know, piled on top of us. And it was probably 2 or 3 minutes before I saw the lights of the stadium again. But just unreal elation, just, you know, to be the last team standing, to have that goal in spring training, to be the last team standing in October, and then to actually have it come to fruition there at Fulton County Stadium was a dream come true.
We've all heard the phrase, time is money, right? Well, that's true. And your time and your money are valuable. Folks, I thought the same thing when I wanted to find out if I was paying too much and getting the best coverage when it came to my home and auto insurance. That's when I connected with Clayton Rhodes at the Rhodes Group. The Rhodes Group is a local insurance agency whose job is to shop for the best rates and the best coverage for all of us here in the state of Georgia. You can spend up to 3 hours or more shopping yourself, or you can delegate that errand to the experts at the Rhodes Group and let them do it for you. That's exactly what I did. I had the Rhodes Group shop for better rates and better coverage for me and my family. And they did it, and they did it really well. When it was all said and done, the Rhodes Group saved me a ton of cash, and they can do the same for you. The Rhodes Group shopped my home and auto rates and saved me nearly $2,000 a year. And at times like this, every dollar counts. So at no cost to you, the Rhodes Group can shop your rates to find out if they can save you time and get you better coverage. I want you to go online to rhodes-group.com/turnoff. They spell it rhodes-group.com/turnoff or call 678-341-9667. Let the experts at the Rhodes Group save you time, aggravation, and money. He was always known as the human highlight film, one of the great dunkers of all time, and the greatest Atlanta Hawk of all time. Great chance to catch up with the Hall of Famer, Dominique Wilkins.
So when the trade comes up and it's the Hawks and they offer two players and $1 million in cash and you get to come not too far away from where you played college ball, did that feel like a dream scenario?
I felt like I died and went to heaven, you know, because I wanted to be in Atlanta because my family had moved here. And so they kind of started to you know, put some roots into the city. And so I wanted to be a Hawk. And it, amazingly, you know, it happened. You know, they made a deal to trade Freeman Williams, John Drew, and $1 million to get me here in Atlanta. Man, that was a blessing.
Tell me about your first time in Atlanta, meeting Ted Turner, meeting the Hawks. What was your first reaction?
Well, Ted was great. You know, Ted was great. Ted was like one of the guys more so than the owner. He was a really charismatic guy, and he really wanted me in Atlanta. So, you know, Ted and I over time became very, very good friends. Even to this day, I'm very close friends with Ted Turner.
What was the city like when you got here in 1982 compared to now?
It was, you know, and they didn't know what to expect, you know, from a young rookie coming in from you. Even though they've seen me play a lot, you know, at the University of Georgia, they didn't know really what to expect from our team. They knew what talent was coming, but I think that first year, we began to show them what we was about, you know, and then we added some more pieces. And you got Kevin Willis, you got Doc Rivers, and guys like Spud. So you got some nice pieces, and you know, Randy Whitman and people like that. So we built a culture here. I mean, a hard nosed 9-to-5 type of team that came to work. And man, that was the first time. You know, we set Atlanta on fire.
Well, I think that's a great point to bring up, right? Because we live in this era now where Braves have been good for a long time. Falcons have had blips where they've been good. When you guys start to take over Atlanta, Braves are kind of going into a lull. The Falcons hadn't been very good. I mean, it was about this young Atlanta Air Force at Hawk team. How was it for you around the city on a day-by-day basis?
Man, I mean, it was kind of indescribable because the people here basically accepted me as a native son here. And everywhere I would go, I mean, they just loved you. You know, and because I was one of those guys that never traveled with entourages and security and all that crap, you know, people was more connected to you. They felt like they can touch you. They can talk to you, you know, and that was what I was all about. Always been kind of a people's person. I wanted people to know that they can be connected to me. I used to stop in playgrounds on the way to games and see kids playing. I used to tell Tree Rollins, let's stop over here and play with these kids and, you know, give them a thrill and, you know, make their day. You know, let's just do something cool for the kids. I mean, I used to do stuff like that all the time. But it's the connection that I had with the city that made it so special.
Neek, you mentioned the core that came in. So Fratello comes in, Doc enters the fray, and Willis and Levingston, Carr, and you mentioned Tree. I mean, you guys all of a sudden had a nucleus where you were on the doorstep of winning the Central Division and winning 50 games a year. When did you realize how special that was?
I knew after my first 2 years, after the first 2 years, that we could be a really special team. And, you know, you had them hard-nosed guys like Tree Rollins and Dan Rounfield, who really kind of took me under their wing and really taught me the NBA game.
And then you had young guys coming in like Doc, and you had Kevin, like you said, Antoine Carr, Cliff. And we had some hard-nosed dudes, man, that came to work, you know. And, I mean, that's all you can ask for. I mean, if I had to go to battle with someone, it would be those guys.
Well, and at that time,
it would be those guys.
Well, I just want to ask you, so, you know, we wax poetic about the 80s for good reason, but there were big-time teams everywhere in the East that you guys could run and jump and you guys could go up and down, but you had that crew that you said were hard-nosed because you had the Pistons and the Celtics and the Sixers. I mean, it was just the Bucks. It was one after another every night.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we had one of the best defenses in the league. I mean, we were the defensive team. You came into the Omni, which we used to call the birdcage back then. I mean, you had to be ready. If you didn't ready, we ran you out of the gym. I mean that's just what. Then you, unfortunately, during that time, the East was loaded with talent. You know, you had Philly, you had Chicago, you had New York, you had Milwaukee, Cleveland, you know. It just had New York. You had so many teams that were good teams, the championship-type teams today. I mean, it was brutal with talent back then.
But let's talk about the one that, and I know growing up here, when the Celtics came in, it felt like there's royalty of Bird and McHale and Parrish and DJ and Ainge. And what you guys built, and first it was the Pistons, but really with you and the Celtics with some of the both regular season and postseason series, what was that battle like for you as you went along through your career?
Man, some of the greatest battles I've ever had as a professional, no question about it, man. Larry Bird brought out the best of me, you know. I mean, because, you know, here you had arguably five Hall of Famers. You did have five Hall of Famers on that team at one time going against one in Atlanta, you know. And so if I didn't score 30-plus a night against those guys, it was hard for us to win. And so we accepted the challenge. But, you know, one thing I will say about those guys I played with, man, you talking about guys who played hard for you, had your back, we never had issues. You never had heard of an issue that any of us had as players, particularly in the media. We never, because we always believe if there's a problem to be resolved, we resolve it in our locker room. No one's need to resolve our problems. So we kind of policed ourselves, and we built such a great bond that couldn't be broken.
So, Nika, and I think you might have told me this story before, but I want to do it for the listeners because I just love it so much. Was there a point where maybe it was Willis, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, where he started talking trash with Larry Bird, and it set Larry off to the point where he went nuts one night?
Yeah, I was mad at Kevin after that game. Because we coming down the court. The game is close. This is a 1-2-point game. And Kevin is on the right of mine, and Bird, I'm running to the right of him. So Kevin reaches across my chest and put his finger in Bird, said, "Don't let this so-and-so score anymore tonight." And I looked at Kevin, I'm like, "What are you doing?" Bird's eyes got so big, I knew it was on then. I knew it was going to be a shootout. And that fourth quarter, that I was sitting on the bench when he got started, and he got hot. And the coach said, "Nick, go back in. You got to slow him down." I said, "Slow him down? He's hot now. Only thing I can do is go out there and match him bucket for bucket." And that set up probably the greatest shootout in the seventh game in history.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that in a minute. But that series itself, that felt like kind of a turning point opportunity for the franchise. For Hawk fans who don't remember, the Hawks and, again, the Celtics were as good as it gets. You guys are in the second round. You won in the Boston Garden in game five, which – nobody ever won in the playoffs. So let's start there before we go to game six. What are your memories of that game five winning there?
I remember it was hot. It was really hot. And, you know, of course the odds was against us to beat them in game five. But the one thing we said coming out of the locker room, we said, okay, we got to come out. We got to hit first, you know, and we got to make every possession important. We can't have mistakes. We can't turn the ball over. He said, if we can do that, we're going to beat them tonight. And that's exactly the way we played in that game.
So then you go home. Tell me about the day between Game 5 and Game 6. I mean, the city must have been on fire because this was a coronation opportunity to finally dethrone them.
Yeah, I mean, the city was on – I mean, it was on fire. I mean, we had people at the airport waiting on us to come back in from that trip. That's how excited they were. And I remember in that game, again, the game we should have won, we gave that game away. We had our opportunities. And the play was designed for – you know, inbound the ball, and somehow the ball gets back to me. I can't remember exactly what it was. And I remember Cliff, I think he had a brain lapse for a second, and he just took off and went to the basket. and threw a left-hand running hook, and I'm like, no, no, no. And we ended up losing that game, and Bird made the bold prediction. He said Atlanta had the opportunities.
Well, the memory I have,
I'm guaranteeing a win.
I hated it watching Dennis Johnson's finger go up in the air as he dribbled the ball down court after that missed shot, because you had to go back for the game seven there, which leads to what you just said. Still to this day, if you watch NBA Classics or anywhere, that game with you in Boston in that fourth quarter, I mean, I imagine nerves are always a part of any NBA player in the postseason. What were your nerves like going into that game? And take me through your thinking, knowing you were going to have to pull off a huge upset in game seven.
Well, you know, coming out of the locker room, because I remember Bird made the prediction. And as I'm coming out of the locker room, I turned and said to my teammates, I said, we're going to win this bleep bleep game. I said, if you ain't ready to fight, if you ain't ready to go to war, don't come out here tonight, because whoever guarding me tonight going to have a long night. Unfortunately, Bird was telling his teammates the same thing down the up end. So it just set up for a unbelievable game. And again, that it was another game where it was so hot in that building that, I mean, you had to, you know, catch your breath at times, you know. But it was the best basketball atmosphere that you could ever imagine. And it set up for one of the greatest games ever in a seventh game. I mean, that game was, it was blow after blow from both teams. Nobody blinked, you know, and this came down to who was going to match each other's will between Larry and I. And I remember after the game, he said, we both deserved to win, but unfortunately, one of us got to go home.
Do you think that was that turning point game, though? Have you guys won that? Is that a championship team that all of a sudden the direction changes?
I knew if we'd have won that game, we'd have won the championship. I seriously believe that to this day. If we would have won that series, we'd have won the NBA championship. Hmm. It was hard to get out of the East, man.
Between the Pistons and the Celtics, and then all of a sudden here come the Bulls with Jordan and Pippen later. But, Nick, let me ask you about two things in that era. First of all, how important was the slam dunk contest to you? Because it felt so different to a lot of us watching then, because it was still new enough and still fun enough with you and Michael, and then a couple of years later with Spud coming in. How big of a deal was it to you?
I mean, you know what? The dunk contest was special for us because it really wasn't about us. It was about the fans. We wanted to give the fans what they came to All-Star Weekend to see. The dunk contest trumped the All-Star game. I mean, that was the show. That and the three-point contest was bigger than life. And you know, people always say, well, you know, Dominique was a great player, won the slam dunk contest, you know, twice. And I'm like, you know what? The slam dunk contest I did for thrills and for the fans. It wasn't who I was. I used it for a tool for intimidation, but it's very difficult to get over 26,000 on dunks. So that's a tool I use, you know. But at the same time, it was special for us because we know the fans were going to buy tickets to see the greatest athletes go head to head.
And, of course, it culminated with you and Michael in Chicago to this day. You don't have to say it, I will. You got robbed.
Slightly. Yeah, got robbed.
But take me through that atmosphere in Chicago. You and Michael, arguably the two best dunkers, not only of the generation, but outside maybe of Vince, maybe of all time. How crazy was that day?
It was. You know, the fact that we're talking about later, 32 years later, it tells you it's the greatest dunk contest ever. Because, you know, we were the standard bears of that contest. You know, I thought Dr. J, who I look at as granddaddy of us all, really set the stage for what we eventually did as players. But that contest, I knew I had to be near perfect to win. And I thought I was, actually, but, you know, judges thought otherwise.
Did you and Michael joke about it later?
Well, we didn't really joke about it. I think I said, he said, look, Nick, you know you won, I know you won, but you're in Chicago. I said, I'll tell you what, give me $100,000 that you got for winning, or we can call it even.
I love it. That's tremendous. What about Atlanta's Air Force, the video? For those who don't know, you can go YouTube it and see it. But in the 80s of, you know, the Bears and the Super Bowl shuffle, everybody was doing these videos. How did that come about for you guys, and what were your thoughts on it?
That was so much fun. And we really enjoyed that because it really started to, you know, send around the league, around the city, what we were about and how hard we played. But one of the biggest things is how, out as a team, we played above the rim. I mean, we had 13 guys that, you know, were basically, arguably said, were guys who played above the rim. And so we got that Air Force title from the way we played.
Who was most uncomfortable? Because the video looked like either an argument of Doc or Konkak either looked really uncomfortable.
Well, if you watch Doc and Konkak, they can't dance a lick. Terrible. I don't know what Doc was doing. He was across between the Icky Shuffle and the Pee Wee Herman. I don't know what he was doing. But
all I remember is his hands going up in some weird way.
Yeah. He had no rhythm. He had no rhythm.
So after you lose to the Celtics again, there were some changes, right? You guys would eventually bring in Moses and Theis to add more offense, and that was supposed to be the pieces that put you guys over the top. Why do you think it didn't work?
You know, first of all, you had Asian guys, and Moses, bless his heart, and it's gone now, and Reggie Theis, and it wasn't a good mix, so it didn't really work, you know.
Just wrong personalities, wrong kind of style.
Wrong mix. Yeah, it was just wrong mix at that time.
I'm thrilled to announce a brand new partner of ours here on Welcome to Matlanta. It's Abulous Landscape Lighting. Yes, Abulous Lighting has done a great job of keeping my home really beautiful and lit up for the holiday season over the last 3 years. And so many folks think of that and say, well, what else can Abulous Landscape Lighting do? Well, here's an idea. They can do a free layout, design, and estimate for you, and they can do it virtually. Whether it's home accents or landscapes, deck and path, specialty lighting, they have it all. Residential and commercial opportunities for everybody from Abulous Landscape Lighting. I want you to mention Real Matlanta, and you're going to get $150 off a complete new system. Abulous Lighting can do no-contact designs and estimates via the web, and they can also do the conversion and repair. They're Metro Atlanta's highest-rated landscape lighting service with the latest LED technology and pro-grade equipment and installation. Lighting increases all the home value that we want, and it presents that curb appeal. Abulous Landscape Lighting will make your home look better at night than it does in the daytime. Go to abuluslighting.com. That's abuluslighting.com. Mention Real Matlanta. Get $150 off that brand new complete system from Abulous Landscape Lighting. They're fabulous. The Great Dane was a name that he earned, and he had an unbelievable career, starting with those New Orleans Saints, but making a better choice to make the switch to become an Atlanta Falcon, and he had the biggest kick in Falcons history, the Hall of Famer Morton Anderson.
And you guys did that. You guys go into the playoffs against the hated 49ers. In this city, man, we got memories of the 49ers doing things to us, so when that draw came up, everybody went, oh boy. But you guys took care of that with a two-point win. Then that week of Minnesota came up, Mort, and I'll just give you my memory because I want it from your perspective. I remember saying that's a 15-1 Minnesota team, and everybody neglected that you guys were 14-2. You guys were a double-digit underdog going up there. And on the outside, everybody went, it's been a nice year. This is about as far as we'll go. Internally, I'm sure that certainly wasn't the message. How did you guys receive what was being said about you?
Nobody thought we were going to win, including our fans. I really felt that. I said, how is it possible that a team that's 14-2 has got to go on the road and be the underdog? This is crazy. Normally at 14-2, you're at home, and you're the fave. So I think it just stoked the fire more. Guys were – there was no lack of enthusiasm or confidence in my mind. We felt that if we hung around, and we knew that the Vikings were good. Heck, they had Randy Moss. He was a rookie. They had they were very explosive offensively. They had set records. We were aware of that, but so had we. We had a heck of a year. I mean, one game, we're 14-2 between the two teams, 29 wins and three losses. Not too shabby. It was going to be, we knew it was going to be a battle. We knew it was going to be a hell of a game. And if we stuck around and kept it close, we'd find a way in the end to win it. And that's exactly what happened.
So before we get to your moment, explain to the people listening the noise level in the Metrodome from right before Gary Anderson's about to kick what everybody thought was the punctuation kick to send him to the Super Bowl, and then the quiet when he missed.
Yeah, the quiet when he missed, it was loud. Well, it was actually very quiet when he kicked because, they like to keep it quiet. It was when I came in overtime and kicked, it got really loud. It was loud, and then it was deafening silence as the ball came through. I think we were all surprised because Gary was 35 for 35. It was one of the top kickers in the history of the game. There's no debating that. So I didn't like our chances. I mean, it was a 38-yarder, 40 and in. He's pretty deadly. So when he did pull the ball to slightly left, I said, this is our day, and because it kept the game at a touchdown.
And it gave us a chance to put together a drive at the end of the fourth quarter where Chris Chandler was brilliant, and his throw to Terrence Mathis on the comeback route where Terrence recognized that Chris was scrambling and had to get in front of the safety, and Chris threw it the only place he could down low, and Terrence T-Mad went and got that ball, and I had to come in and kick what turned out to be a really important extra point. So, and I actually had to kick it twice because the Vikings jumped off sides. That was more nerve-wracking than anything.
I'm thrilled to announce a brand new partner of ours here on Welcome to Mountlanta. It's Abulous Landscape Lighting. Yes, Abulous Lighting has done a great job of keeping my home really beautiful and lit up for the holiday season over the last 3 years. And so many folks think of that and say, well, what else can Abulous Landscape Lighting do? Well, here's an idea. They can do a free layout, design, and estimate for you, and they can do it virtually. Whether it's home accents or landscapes, deck and path, specialty lighting, they have it all. Residential and commercial opportunities for everybody from Abulous Landscape Lighting. I want you to mention Real Mountlanta, and you're going to get $150 off a complete new system. Abulous Lighting can do no-contact designs and estimates via the web, and they can also do the conversion and repair. They're Metro Atlanta's highest-rated landscape lighting service with the latest LED technology and pro-grade equipment and installation. Lighting increases all the home value that we want, and it presents that curb appeal. Abulous Landscape Lighting will make your home look better at night than it does in the daytime. Go to abuluslighting.com. That's abuluslighting.com. Mention Real Mountlanta. Get $150 off that brand new complete system from Abulous Landscape Lighting. They're fabulous.
That's interesting. Yeah. And then the overtime, which, I mean, I can't even imagine being on the sideline, but as the fan watching every big throw the Vikings would put up top to Randy Moss or a deep shot to Chris Carter, you held your breath. But eventually you guys put a drive together, and O.J. Santiago had a big catch on the drive, and there were just a couple of big plays, and all of a sudden you come in. So, and I've asked you about this before, but I'm fascinated by it. Mentally, emotionally, how do you control yourself and the emotions and the mental part of preparing for that kick?
Well, part of my pre-game ritual would be to – I did a lot of visualization, what I call cognitive intervention. So that kick was made Saturday night in the hotel room. I would do a lot of visualizing, writing down notes, putting together scenarios that might come up in a game. And one of those scenarios I had written Saturday night was a 38-yarder from the left hash in overtime to win the game. And I still have the notepad. Still have that kick written in there, and that's exactly what happened. So I really felt very good about our chances at that point because I knew that it was very realistic. We're going to have a high probability. We're going to have a good snap, a good hold, and I'm capable, more than capable, of making this kick. I've done it. I can do this in my sleep. I mean, 38 yards, usually I'm close to 100%, 40 yards and in, so I was not that worried. Now, I know my teammates, they weren't in control. They were on their knees holding hands. I get it. They're not driving the car at that point. I am. So I knew we were going to win. I knew we were going to go to the Super Bowl. I just didn't tell anybody. And when I went out there, it was loud. The ground was shaking. It moved. I don't know how, but it was vibrating. And, of course, when they called timeout, I was just there standing on and just getting my target line and my breathing regulated and went to the ball, hit it solidly. As soon as I hit it, I knew it was going right down the middle. I started running, and it got really quiet in there. But for a few Falcons fans up in the nosebleeds, they were going nuts. It was great.
So when you kick it, you said, because I remember you start turning your back and running with your hands up. Does it does it get sort of like blank in your mind at that point? Or, I mean, what's the emotion at that very moment before the podium comes out and the trophy comes out? What is that couple of moments like?
It was just a rush of adrenaline through my body that I cannot describe. It was a high that I wish you could bottle and bring forth, you know, at special parties and moments where you just pure exuberation, pure joy, pure relief and release. and all of those things. And but the most just adrenaline, absolute tremendous amount of adrenaline pumping through your body, and you feel like you're invincible at that moment. And then when you see your teammates and their joy, you realize the moment is there, and that you did it, and you were part of it. And then it becomes a little bit blurry. It becomes, you get this hot sensation through your body. You get it's just pure joy. You know, this is at the highest level when you compete and you have these moments. They you want them to last a lot longer. You feel like it's lasting forever, but it's really fast and fleeting. And then you're on to the next thing. It's just yeah, amazing, really amazing. Yeah.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Welcome to Matlanta. I want to thank our sponsors, and I hope you guys will support these great local businesses as well. Abulous Landscape Lighting. That's abuluslighting.com. Mention Real Matlanta, get $150 off that brand new complete system from Abulous Landscape Lighting. They're fabulous. Also, the Rhodes Group, great insurance agency here locally, working with Jordans to try to find us the best rates, save us aggravation and time when getting the best for our auto and home. Go to Rhodes-Group.com/churnoff. Again, that's Rhodes, Rhodes-Group.com/churnoff for more. Thank you to Brian Murphy for producing the podcast. We will talk to you next week on Welcome to Matlanta.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Welcome to Atlanta, where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, uh-huh. And parties don't stop. Yeah.